Yeah, 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 come and take a look at the snow. Bright white as far as your eyesight goes. Come and take a look at the fields of snow. I'll just get my coat, then we're good to go. Come and take a look at the lake. Let's have a quick skate before it gets late. Come and take a look at the frozen lake. Put your clothes on, mate, don't make that mistake.
Greetings, holiday shoppers. There are now only 211 shopping days left until Christmas, and I think you know what that means. That means it's Christmas Creeps time once again. This is Christmas Creeps, your one-stop shop for holiday movies and TV shows all year round. Hi, my name is Joseph Wade. I'll be your host for this evening. Here with me tonight is my co-host, Mr. Bradford. Brad, what's going on?
I'm just enjoying this lovely month that we have created, that has been created for us.
Yeah, Brad's been taking the reins on the show this month, but I'm taking it back for this final episode of Anime. But thank you, Brad. I appreciate the fact that you've sort of forced me into watching all of this good Christmas holiday anime. I've actually enjoyed it more than I thought I would.
Good.
But tonight we have a very special treat. To wrap up anime, we are discussing Tokyo Godfathers from 2003. And with us tonight on the show to discuss it are Niall and Dwayne from the Secret of the Sailor Madness podcast. Hey, welcome to the show, guys. Yeah.
Hello.
Doing very well. Now, I've been on your show a couple of times, but this is the first time we've had you on ours. So we're very
it's
happy
quite
to
the
have
honor.
You.
Thank you.
The honor's all ours.
So for the listeners at home who may not know what a Secret of the Sailor Madness is, why don't you explain what the show is for...
Well, what it is a podcast that we should have probably thought of a better name of rather than the ones we picked off of a random name generator for our reviews for our rock band names. But what it actually is...
I disagree. I think it's a great name.
It's a pretty good name. It's evocative, but people say it's a pretty good name for a thing, but they don't know what the hell it's about.
What's the thing?
So you gotta tell them. It's a podcast about animation of all sorts, which we like to just talk about often at great length and various things. So we go back, we're on the gamut all the way back to like black and white cartoons of the days of yore, all the way up to the hottest things. Well, hottest, I don't know if you call it that. Recent things, anyway. Everything else in between. Trying to shy away from the usual kind of disparaging, oh, cartoons in the old days were so old and weird, and just like kind of talking about some bad episode of G.I. Joe or some shit for 3 hours in excruciating detail. We try to be kind of more of a positive aspect of it. We try to like find the good and the merit and what things may have like spun off from that, what inspired it, where did it go. And we've been trying to experiment with kind of different formats recently, trying to implement stuff like music videos and advertising. And we got a few other things in the pipeline wanting to try out.
Cool.
And then the rest of the time, we also have a little side gig with some friends, a pal of ours, who runs an exclusively anime podcast called Let's Go, talking about anime week to week, which we are contributors to. So we're well-versed in animation up and down, left and right, you name it. We've probably watched it or are aware of it in some fashion.
We talk about cartoons is what we do,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, and specifically, I know your website says you're the cynicism-free animation appreciation podcast, which, you know, we dabble in cynicism here on Christmas.
Really?
But when things are going well and we actually watch something that is worth engaging with and talking about, you know, we have no problem saying that we love something. Kind of like the movie that we watched tonight, Tokyo Godfathers, which I had never seen before, I actually found myself really enjoying. Who would like to lead us off? Brad, explain Tokyo Godfathers. I command it.
Oh, the plot or just everything in general?
just the overview of what it
20 words
is.
Or less.
Okay.
Go.
Okay.
Do it in No. Do it in a haiku.
Oh, gosh. You have to give me a second.
All right. That's fine.
Counting on the fingers. I know.
Okay. Definitely. The first line is definitely Tokyo Godfathers.
3 hours later.
God damn. I'm counting on my fingers. It's actually pretty difficult. I'm trying to even describe the characters. You know, it's like a drunk cross dresser. The second one's 5 syllables, isn't it? Or is it 7?
It's 7.
It's 575.
Shit. I can't maybe, be a teenager in the same fucking line.
Maybe this bit is comedy poison. I don't know.
I'm almost done here. I've almost got
okay,
it.
Okay.
Do believe in Bradford.
Okay, here we go.
Oh wow, that was fast. Okay.
Tokyo Godfathers is an anime movie. It's a very... dang it.
No, you're good. That's fine.
Yes.
That's fine. You're good.
No.
You ended it with just, okay. It's a very good, like, you're done.
It's a very good movie.
It's a very good.
Oh, God.
For sale, never won.
Tokyo Godfathers for sale, never watched.
Okay. We did watch this, though. Yeah.
Doesn't have a baby.
This is... Tokyo Godfathers is a movie that came out in 2003. It is a Satoshi Kon joint, known for some other works like Paprika and Paranoia Agent. There are probably some other notable... I mean, there are definitely other notable movies that he did in his time. He has since passed. I believe he passed in 2010. It is a Christmas movie. That's why we're talking about it here. We can get further into the plot synopsis, but it's a good movie. I had never seen it before. I had been meaning to for the longest time, and I'm very glad that I did. Neil and Dwayne?
I didn't see when it came out initially, but I've caught it after. I don't think it's in my regular Christmas rotation, but I think it's in my irregular one where it'd be one of the ones that I'd put on because it's a classic.
Yeah, irregular one, but I think I hadn't watched it in quite a while prior to this. I had the DVD collection. I remember I got in like a secondhand shop somewhere. I thought, oh man, because I knew at the time that a lot of the releases of his films that went rapidly out of print and you're only sort of like getting around to maybe re-releasing some of them in recent years, I think. I think they only put out a new version of Perfect Blue, one of his the first kind of feature director, actually, just last year, I believe. So when I saw it...
That's crazy, like, because I remember when Black Swan came out, and everyone was like, this is just fucking Perfect Blue, and everyone was like, perfect what? Yeah.
It's definitely like a film that comes up a lot when we're making a kind of watch a Christmas anime out there, and this is always like the top of the heap because it's full of Christmas spirit. It's about three wise men or three wise people trying to get a baby back to his parents on Christmas Eve, well, and running over into New Year's as well, but yeah,
over the holidays.
What's more Christmassy than a baby at Christmas? I mean, come on. I had actually never seen this before, and this is always one that was kind of on my sort of radar. I knew we would have to get to this eventually, and we just needed the right excuse for Brad to make me watch it. and here we are. But also, I'm pretty sure Brad, our pal Booker, has requested that we do this episode of this film several times, so we're finally making good on that.
The best thing about this is you could go back and just go to any of the old adaptations of it, because it's based on a novel from 1913 by Peter B. Keane called Three Godfathers, and that was between 1960 and 1948. Like, it made multiple films, two of them by John Ford.
Yeah, there was like at least one cowboy one, a John Wayne one.
Yeah,
I think.
Well, the book itself is based on like the old West frontier, about ultimately either bank robbers or cattle rustlers or stagecoach bandits who find like a baby scattered in the wilderness, and they think it about themselves to try and bring it back to bring it to safety, because it's they find a mother, but she dies giving birth, and then these outlaws are redeemed by their good deed.
Yeah, that's another one that I want to get to at some point. We're going to have to like come up with an excuse to do nothing but Western Christmas movies, and I think there might only be two of them. that'll work out quite nicely. Tokyo Godfathers. How do we want to start to work our way into the plot of this movie?
I suppose to start just talking about Satoshi Kon and his kind of way, I think it's... Like, a lot of people don't, or her fans of his, don't really like it because it's one of his more lighthearted ones.
Really?
But honestly, sometimes I have trouble, like, if I watch one of these things, I feel like this film's of his I haven't finished because I watched them late at night and I was too disturbed to finish them, that kind of thing. I'm just like, can't watch this right now. It's getting in my fucking head. This one I find like a really fun watch. It just kind of shows off his flair as well without...
Well, okay, so knowing that and knowing that this is like his sort of one shot at a Christmas film, do you think that in future years and future generations it's going to have sort of the Frank Capra effect where at the time people kind of look down on it as, oh, this is way too corny, way too schmaltzy, and then over time it just became the one that he's been most known for? Do you think that's going to happen?
Most known for, I wouldn't say. I think that would still be probably like Perfect Blue and probably Paranoid in the TV series. Millennium Actress, perhaps, is that's quite an innovative phenomenon in itself. But definitely, like, you know, when, let's say, if you're talking to any anime fan, whether they're in deep or does somebody who just like kind of skims and just kind of watches like I think once in a while, they're probably aware of this film existing and probably watches Christmas themselves.
That's fair. Yeah, I know, realizing full well that I am talking to three people who watch a lot more anime than I ever will. So
like too much,
but no, I get what you mean. Like Satoshi Kon is another one of those like directors who's crossed over, should we say, into the mainstream, you know, following on from your Studio Ghibli, say, and that kind of thing, and. I'd say maybe in that pantheon is probably one of the more overlooked ones, but I'd say anybody who has delved into that at any point has probably like, given this a go at least at some point. But as I said, it's kind of hard to come by on a home video these days. They make it around to hopefully like releasing it at some point in the near future, but that remains to be seen. It's still kind of outrageous how some of these like big ticket films and features and TV series. I don't like this. It was like, yeah, again, like he'd be brought up in the same breath as your Studio should be, like the Miyazaki or your Katsuya or Otomo or any of that. Brought up in the same breath, but just not nearly the same level of like availability for his works for much the rest of the world, you know?
We had trouble tracking this down a little bit, actually. I wanted to watch this free of commercials.
Yeah.
The only place that it's legally available outside of owning a DVD copy, at least in North America, is on a service called Crackle, which forces you to watch interstitial ads, which is not, as you can imagine, is not the best for a movie. So we were subjected to Local Farm ads and Cold Stone Creamery ads and all sorts of other wonderful HVAC repair ads throughout.
Can I just say how strange that phenomenon is, though? Like, I'm used to seeing ads for major, you know, big movies that are coming out, or, you know, Coca-Cola or things like that, on watching streaming things on the internet. I have never in my life until today seen an ad for a farm that is like 20 miles from my house.
Targeted.
Extremely targeted, like on an anime film that I'm watching on the internet. It just weirded me out. Like, Big Brother really is watching you.
Hello, Joseph Wade. We have detected that you only have 5 eggs left in your refrigerator. Please follow the directions that we have just printed out on your printer to go to this farm. Enjoy the rest of your movie.
Oh, God.
So I'm going to give away my opinion of this film, but I probably will track it down on DVD, but I was a little disappointed that it wasn't available just to buy on a streaming service, which is usually how I tend to go these days.
Right.
Yeah.
You do see that with a lot of other anime films, though. I believe a lot of Studio Ghibli films are not available through these sort of, you know, iTunes, Amazon streaming sort of.
That's because Ghibli's distributed by Disney,
yeah.
Isn't it?
I think Disney lost the rights to that fairly recently.
Did they? I thought they still had the digital rights.
Check some of the discs I have. Let's see. It was like, what are those guys? I can see the logo on my mind. They released like a lot of East Asian cinema.
Funimation? The people who did the MST3K ones,
Shout Factory.
No, are they a fucking French company? It's gonna drive me bananas now. I can see the logo here on the thing, but I can't read the side of the case. It's a little swirl.
Well, yeah, it's one of the weird things. Like, I was kind of hoping, especially with his untimely passing, that a lot of Satoshi Kon's stuff would get picked up and like rediscovered and redistributed, like you're saying, Joseph, where it would become like maybe a bigger classic, not just among the people who are in the know or in and around the know, but like in general. I think it's a, like this, for example, is a solid Christmas movie, and his psychological horror works quite well outside of just the Japanese audience.
Okay, yeah. Well, yeah, we can definitely sort of get our way into the plot of this movie. I think the best way to do it is to just start talking about the titular Tokyo, the three Tokyo Godfathers.
Hmm.
So our three main characters in this film are three homeless people of varying backgrounds. They all have their different reasons for being cast out onto the street and staying that way. And throughout the film, we kind of learn first about sort of their stated reasons for being on the streets, and then what actually happened to them. So there's a lot of sort of back and forth as to the who and the why of all these events. But our main three characters are Jin, who claims he was a former bicycle racer who lost a pretty major bet on a race of some kind. That's how he put it.
Took a fall, yeah.
Through the race.
Right. He threw the race and got found out.
Yeah, he threw the race to make money because his daughter had a terminal illness.
That's right.
And the money he'd used to he'd get paid for throwing the race, he could use towards curing it, but he got found out and he got run out of the, I was going to say industry, run out of the sport.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Hannah is a transgender woman or cross-dressing man. It's weird in Japan. There's like what's the word?
Okama is the
Okama.
Term.
There's a very little distinction between being gay, being a cross-dresser, and being transgender, and it's just generally under that umbrella.
There are terms that kind of, I guess, emerge.
What I'm saying is it tends to get... Yeah, yeah. What I'm saying is it tends to get all lumped under like the one thing.
Especially in the early aughts, this was definitely a phenomena. I can't speak to it now, and I know there are
I imagine it's more
terms.
Varied now. Sure, yeah.
Yeah. And you'll see this in the translation where if you listen to the original audio, they're using both, Gin and other characters are referring to Hana as an Okama. She refers to herself as such as well, but they translate it different ways in different parts of the translation. Sometimes they translate it as the, especially early, it's odd, they translate it as the F slur. But they also translate it as, like gay and queer. And it's interesting, and I was trying to find online some definitive source of saying whether or not Okama is pejorative in the way that certain homophobic slurs are in English. And I
think it's like,
find any.
Like if you self-identified as, I mean, like a lot of gay people self-identify with the F word, that kind of thing. I think it's the thing in Japanese of where they're referring to it as the vulgar language and the polite language. So
right,
if you
yeah.
say mm-hmm. Okama while being polite about talking about yourself, it comes across as, oh, I'm gay, I'm a homosexual. Whereas if someone says it in the pejorative kind of accusatory language, it comes across as offensive just by the way you worded it.
Yeah.
If the word itself isn't offensive, it's just everything that the sentence is built makes it offensive.
Yeah, it can...
Very
yeah, it can be
yeah yeah yeah
it can have like
it's not a perfect translation
it can have like a derogatory context because it was associated in days past with prostitutes, so it still has that kind of cachet of like unseemness about it, but it's just sort of been it's the kind of thing that you can use in let's say in private company but wouldn't say like out in public in public speech, should we say. It's kind of sort of being reclaimed, much kind of saying the word, like the word queer, sort of being reclaimed by people in other parts of the world. So similarly to that, but it still has that sort of connotation to it to this day. But it's getting better. It's getting better.
And I was even surprised at how sort of sympathetic the film was to that character at all. Because as soon as she shows up in the film, I thought, oh no, how are they going to play this?
Yeah.
And then it turned out, no, Hannah's fairly... Well rendered, I think, as a fully formed person in this movie. So.
What I appreciate is that they take the piss out of Hannah, but like the same way they take the piss out of every other fucking character in this
yes,
thing.
Yes, exactly.
She's just as much an object of derision as anyone else because of how stupid she acts in certain circumstances, not because she's an Okama. And your man taking the piss out of her by calling her an F word and that kind of thing is just because they're friends and they can call each other motherfuckers if they want. The only thing she actually gets insulted by is if you call her, old man or something like that.
Yeah.
I think
OG-san,
that's her red button.
I think there was the one scene where she says, like, you can call me a fuck, but don't ever call me a fart.
It's sort of like a mistranslation there, because it comes across as...
Yeah, well, I think it's
Oji-san, which is grandpa, basically.
That's it, yeah. It's call him grandpa.
Yeah, what actually kind of sets it off is Kuso Jiji, with what you hear in there. And that's translated as old fart, but it means like smelly / shitty old man. And she's kind of going, you can call me shitty, you can call me old, but don't fucking misgender me like that again or I'll kill you.
This is why I'm glad I have three people on this podcast who actually know how to parse this stuff. Because I am just stepping in it, you know, left and right.
No, and I'm
actually learning here, so I'm kind of going to take a back seat for a little bit of this and just let you all hash this out, because you know what you're talking about, and I appreciate that.
One of the things I appreciate, especially in this movie, and you can see it in a lot of other directors' work, but in this movie, Cohen is picking characters that are... I mean, like, I would say it was just in Japan, but fucking, it's everywhere, man. Where these are people who you would ignore in society, the homeless, people who are homosexual or other than you, angry teens, you know, people whose voices you kind of like go like, let's just ignore them. In this movie as well, migrant workers, that kind of thing. It's like, these are all our characters who we see from their kind of point of view.
That's undesirable, you know, when you call it, of Japanese society. Yeah, and calling me... He took his kind of impetus to make this from like the John Ford Three Godfathers film, but he was also sort of spurred on by seeing the increasing number of homeless people on the streets, which kind of became a chronic problem after the bubble economy in Japan burst in the early 90s. And you want to show the homeless in a more sort of humanizing manner as people trying to do their best in the face of like grave misfortune or kind of trying to foster empathy in an audience that might otherwise have written him off as an ugly burden on society. And
I think it's important that he took the piss out of the characters as well, because he doesn't want you to pity them. He wants you to understand that they're people. So they can be easily mockable, but they are also easily... you can see the circumstances that put them in the situation. And it's not so much pity, but like you say, empathy. And I think it engenders that a lot better.
It's still like a fairly... It's getting a little better, but there's still like quite a lot of stigma attached to being homeless.
They
kind of operate in an out of sight, out of mind approach to it, where they'll kind of shepherd the toys will kind of shepherd the homeless away from the main streets, and so they kind of congregate in little tent villages under a bridge or inside a park or something like that. This is kind of seen as a nuisance by polite mainstream Japanese society, and sometimes viewed as a consequence of your own personal failing. So it's your own fault you're homeless, not that any number of things that can put you out in the street in a flash can happen to you.
That's where I feel like making this specifically sort of a Christmas movie really sort of benefits that story, because you can take the Christmas element out of this movie and it would still be the exact same plot and story. But then when you bring in the holiday element, and then you bring in sort of the... when the film starts off with a children's choir singing Silent Night, that already puts you in the mindset of like, this is a, you know, put it in a religious context. And you think about the homeless, you know, the downtrodden, these people, these are all the people that, you know, Jesus would have hung out with back in the day.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's what the opening sermon is about, in fact.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that's completely intentional there too. But
But I think that the fact that they acknowledge that and bring that to the forefront really makes this film kind of pop a little bit better than it would have had it not been set at Christmas time. I think it brings in the holiday themes a little bit more than a lot of the holiday movies that we've been watching.
Sure. Yeah.
Which you would think it's not that hard to do, but apparently it is, because so many of these are like, look, think back to Bah Humduck, which we just did a couple of weeks ago, and how utterly it fails at just giving, even delivering lip service to the idea of a Christmas carol. Like it's insane.
It's a layup and it failed. It had a template, a pre-established template that it could have used, and somehow it failed at even that.
We had a holiday tradition on our podcast of doing a version of a Christmas carol, because there's so many of them. Right. Over Christmas, but we have to stop because there's too much shit ones that don't fucking get it.
We opted last year to just do Christmas Crown episodes of various things. Some good, some bad. Some were actually just like a good way to sort of sample. This is like a long-running thing that we're very leery of trying to go in like full bore on, i.e. the Back to the Future cartoon.
Yeah, see, we watched that and we were like, eh, no, no, no dice. But seeing how Bravestar adapted a Christmas Carol, it was like, that's actually pretty good. Yeah. We should give this one a shot.
Yeah, so that Bah Humduck was, that was the first time in like 5 years we'd ever touched a Christmas Carol, and knowing how many there are out there, I don't know that we want to do it again.
Yeah,
bitten once, twice so, shy.
We'll point everybody to you guys and let you take care of them.
All right.
Oh, bollocks.
No, you've already done all the hard work for us.
Oh, so. I thought you meant for us to continue to do it. No, and I was okay.
We have archived content there. People can just dive into it.
Precisely. Yes. Synergy. Making this thing pop, baby. Okay, let's keep things moving. The third of the three Godfathers we have yet to discuss is Miyuki, who is a runaway teenager who... What is her stated story that she ran away for?
Like she states like the truth, like my dad's a cop and he's really stuffy, and my mom's, you know, she's always praying to God and fucking shit, whatever. Like, which is all true, but not to the full extent that she's saying.
Yeah, she basically kind of flipped out because they got rid of her precious cat because she loves cats, kittens, she's crazy about them, and she took what looked like one of those sharpened nail files to her dad and just stabbed him in the gut. And he's like, "What'd you do to my cat?" And then her dad is bleeding out and bleeding out, not fatally, but like, "What the fuck did you just do to me? You stabbed me. What are you doing with it?" And her mom is in the corner, not doing anything, just doing her whole the praying to the Buddha. Oh my gosh, what's going on? Please, did this pass over? And then just ran off to the streets. And she's been...
I like the way they don't give you the specifics. They don't give you the specifics of that, but I like the way it's basically saying this kid was clearly under some serious amount of stress. It could have been just like fucking tests and shit. You know, the things that really stress you out when you're a kid. It's like it's your whole world and you just... A small thing is enough to send you to snap. And I'm not saying she's forgiven for it, but that... You can see there was probably some other shit going on in her home life, just expectations on her, because she's very much so, I'm glad I do not have any expectations as a homeless person.
Mm.
It's very understandable, if not relatable. Yeah.
And her situation is unusual as well, because the homeless population in Japan is predominantly it's predominantly male. Hana excluded, of course.
Yeah.
That's kind of as well... Mm. As a result of sort of discriminatory hiring practices in some like regular kind of Japanese salaryman office things, they would prefer to hire or keep on men who are married because they see that they have dependents and people that they need to kind of care about as well. Whereas if something happens to you, whether you get divorced or anything else that could cause you to separate from your partner, you're not viewed in the same light, and you could find yourself without a job suddenly. And so a lot of these guys are like, could have been dudes who were like trading stocks and making $1 million a minute like a couple of years back, and now they're just on the streets foraging in bins, you know.
Yeah, and it immediately makes me think of has anybody else seen the movie Kumiko the Treasure Hunter?
I know of it. I haven't seen it.
It's basically about sort of a 20-something office girl who quits her job to go out in search of the briefcase full of money from the movie Fargo because she thinks that's real.
It's way more interesting than that. It's based on an urban legend that circulated in the American Midwest that there was this woman that came out here to search for the briefcase.
Wait. It's an urban legend based on an urban legend that was invented for a movie.
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
That's almost literally yes. That's exactly it. But the reason I bring this up is because part of the reason she goes on this quest in the movie is because she is one of these sort of sad office girl workers who hasn't, you know, gotten married and quit her job yet because she's a sad office worker and nobody wants her. So before she can be fired and let go and probably cast aside like these characters are or would have been, she decides to just steal a company credit card and go to Minnesota of her own accord because that's kind of the life that she kind of sees for herself anyway. So I guess all I'm saying is that, like, I can appreciate the angle that they're taking with that sort of thing. That's an odd digression I just made. I apologize.
I think it's okay.
I like
thing.
Being reminded.
It is about, like, you know, this kind of pressure to put up the polite, proper front to the wider world when you could be dealing with Lord knows what inside, but you can't be shown to be buckling underneath it. You got to put on a strong face and you got to be gambate, gambare. Got to keep on going. Got to keep on trucking and possibly work your ass to death.
For what? For nothing. All for nothing. So these three homeless folks, they're dumpster diving, they're trash hunting. They go look for they find a full volume of encyclopedias for
Miyuki.
Thank you.
And it was going to be her Christmas present.
It was going to be her Christmas present. It's a full volume of Encyclopedia. I want to say Britannica, but I know that's not a.
I think it was an encyclopedia for kids or something.
Encarta. Yeah.
I think it was World Children's Literature.
Yeah, yeah, and she Miyuki hates being called a kid.
But then they hear the sound of a baby crying, the unmistakable sound of a crying baby in the trash, and they dig around, and lo and behold, here is this baby wrapped up in a little makeshift trash manger in the middle of the street, in the middle of the city. And Hannah immediately grabs the baby and says, "This is my baby now." But they also go off on this mission to find the parents of the baby, figure out where it came from and why it was dumped on the side of the road. And that is sort of the setup of the whole movie. And then we get this amazing opening credit sequence with this weird jaunty music that after we've just discovered the saddest thing in the world, this baby lying in the trash, and then this jaunty sort of upbeat Christmas music as we see all the opening credits and people's names and directed by and things like that. And our adventure, off on the adventure.
And I'm going to put a pin in that right now and just say that we are going to talk about spoilers. Spoiler alert. There are some things in this movie that are unexpected. If you have not seen this movie and you are planning on seeing this movie, stop this now and go watch it. It's a really good time, and we'll be here when you get back. All right.
It is also, I should say, a blissfully short 90 some minutes.
Yes. Yeah.
Which I'm not saying that I'm glad it was over 90 minutes, but the runtime definitely helps.
But
you know?
Even then, it's dense because I forgot how much happens in this film. It's an odyssey.
Dense,
it's an odyssey for these guys.
There's not a pick on this. You couldn't cut anything. It's so packed in.
Just how much because this is like another underlying theme about kind of miracles and coincidences happening at Christmas, and it's quite impressive how they tie back even minor things into major plot threads or this kind of everything kind of calls back upon itself right up to the very end. It's really impressive how they pulled that off. I appreciate it on this watch through.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, even right down to just random cab drivers constantly reappearing.
How many fucking taxi drivers has got to be in that fucking town, and it's the same guy? He's like, "Ah, son of a bitch, I keep trying to get out, but they pulled me back into their weird fucking shenanigans."
No. It's that lady again.
Man, Uber's on strike, the cab company's on strike, I'm just out here trying to make a buck.
One last aside before we really dive deep into this plot sprint through this plot.
Yes.
You mentioned the jaunty music, and I have to note, this is video game chat coming up, that the music was written by Keiichi Suzuki, who did the music for Earthbound, Hip Tanaka.
Nice.
Which is, and you can really, a lot of the stylings, especially the end credits, you get that sort of warbly, distorted reggae kind of sound that is Earthbound's known for. So something to look out for on your next watch through.
Wait, did you say it was also done by Hip Tanaka? Your man who did Mario Land.
Hip Tanaka also worked on Earthbound, not Tokyo.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I was going to say like that would make sense with the jauntiness. Yeah,
also the different St. Young men, which you want to tie it into Christmas a little more, or at least to Christianity.
It's got a Christmas scene,
and Buddhism,
sure.
Yeah.
I mean, like Jesus is in it, so yeah.
Yeah.
So Bradford, take the wheel.
Oh, goodness. Okay, so they find this baby, and let's start the coincidences rolling already. Hana decides to name it Kyoko, meaning pure child, because it is Christmas Eve, and what other night is purer than Christmas?
Isn't that also a sort of some kind of a translation of, like, transliteration of Silent Night, or am I misremembering that?
That is to be my understanding. I don't know how that works. I'd have to take a deeper dive on that.
Okay.
To confirm it, but I think I read something similar. Gin, meanwhile, is trying to convince Hana to give this baby up to the police, and this becomes a constant refrain. This baby is nothing but trouble. We can't care for it. We're homeless. You need to give this child to the police. Hana eventually convinces Gin to let them keep the baby for one night because she doesn't want to turn this baby into the cops on Christmas Eve, because if, you know, this baby ends up in a foster home, Christmas will basically be tarnished forever for this child, which is understandable.
I think she mentions that she went from house to house and she never really had a home. That's her backstory, because she's an Okama and she never really found a place in this world, which is bullshit. But it's kind of fun. That's her tragic backstory. It's like, oh, come on, I'm never going to have a kid myself. So give me this night. Hana keeps changing her fucking story the entire fucking time. And I love the way she keeps twitching. It's like, I want to raise this baby. It's like, we can't raise the baby. All right, just give me tonight. And it's like, all right, I'll give you tonight. I've decided I want to find the parents on a big quest. And if they can satisfy my fucking curiosity as to why they fucking abandoned their child, then I'll give up.
She's such a diva.
She keeps changing her story.
She's this diva who's all about the drama. She just goes off on this whole tear of, like, no, okay, we got some, like, milk in the bottle for the baby. It's like, oh, yes, this baby, finally a baby. Oh, my own. It's like, this reminds me of a time when I was cast out of my own family. And then the baby's hungry. If you give the baby some milk, please. Gosh, come on. It's all about you.
Yeah.
And
so, Brad, real quick, can we count this as a stamp on the Christmas Creeps bingo card of orphanages?
Orphanages, definitely. Dead parents, we'll get into that.
Okay.
But spoiler alert, no.
I think everyone's parents is alive in this.
Yeah, it's a Christmas,
I think you can't
miracle.
Get that one. Yeah, fuck. Okay. Everyone says their parents are dead, but they're not.
Right, or so their spouses.
Take it back later.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And in this time, I really want to blast through this plot, and I can't do it justice anyways, but we get to begin to get character development. We find out that, you know, Gin used to have a family and used to have a child. He knows how to take care of a baby. And this is when he feeds Hana this bullshit story about, you know, throwing a race for, you know, getting money for his child who's terminally ill. We come to find out that's not going to be the case, but we'll get to that. So they go on this odyssey, and I was going to mention, there's no central character to this plot. I mean, it's kind of equally shared between these three characters, but if I had to name one main character of this story, I would argue that it's Hana, because she's the one really sort of pushing, you know, if it were in the hands of Gin or Miyuki, it would end quickly as they turn it into the police. So she's
yeah,
the one who's running this plot forward, moving this plot forward in many cases, and she's the one who's taking most of the action in a lot of these scenes.
She's very much had the
I'm not going to ruin it, but she gets the biggest win at the end as well. So
yeah. She's very much the mammy going, come on, guys, it's Christmas. Be nice. Come on.
Yes. Okay, so in their investigation, they find a locker key because it was with the baby. They go and open up the locker and find photographs and cards to a hostess club. They begin their journey across the city to wherever this hostess club is located. But along the way, I believe Miyuki sees her father on another train. Her father's calling the police, and she bolts, and the other two have to chase after her. She spills the milk in the process, and they have to go to they're starting to get hungry, so they go to a graveyard where many people leave offerings for their deceased loved ones, and they take some of those offerings. And luckily enough, like, this baby is favored by God, has been blessed by God. Somebody had left some offerings of milk and diapers for presume, what I can only presume is, you know, a deceased baby.
And yeah, sake. I love the way it's like, very they go to the graveyard because Jin's like, yeah, I gotta get fuck arse now. Just like drinking all the drink that's been left out for folks and just like, yeah, there's nothing here for a fucking baby, man. Just forget about it. And
yeah.
And there's like, oh, thank goodness, a baby died at some point. What luck. That's basically what the scene is. And it's kind of like, you're laughing at it, but it's like, this is weird. Everyone's like, oh, brilliant. Someone fucking give this thing to the dead baby. Fantastic.
Brad, yeah, do we have to do Christmas bingo with dead baby?
That is uncharted territory.
The baby
in
was already dead before Christmas, I think.
Well, there was
another baby that was also died before Christmas later on in the story.
That's two dead babies. Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I mean, this just became a massacre of the innocents here, so...
It's that a lot. It's that, but how somehow it maintains it being a comedy, but it's dark as fuck.
It's a real tripwire. It's like a real tightrope act that they're playing here.
It's impressive that it doesn't fucking fall. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's very impressive, yeah. So then they meet a Yakuza boss of some make or description who is trapped under his car because... He's been run over by his own car because of some lady and her dog.
We should mention the weather in this movie.
It keeps coming up. That's true. That's why the trains were stopped because the snow
trains
were
delayed.
That's true.
And that's why this guy got out of his car. We are in the midst of a heavy snowstorm, which is actually, to my knowledge, highly unusual for that region.
Almost miraculous, you might say.
Almost a major coincidence that a lot of this happened. He gets trapped under his car after he goes to check it out, and a woman pushes the car over while chasing after her dog. They push the car off of him, and he is kind enough to give them a ride and some money as a reward, and takes them to his daughter's wedding.
You've done a favor for me. On the day of my daughter's wedding, anything you want, your wish is my command.
I like the way the daughter's like giving out to him, and then he's like, see these guys over here, they saved my life. It's like, you treat them right. You know, so anytime Jin takes two fucking bottles of wine off the server's platter, everyone's just like, yeah, it's fine. Those guys
are the most stereotypical like mob boss thing ever, honestly.
This guy seems sound out. I mean, like, what kind of fucking criminal is he that he got ran over by his own goddamn car? Not a very good one, apparently.
He's a boss. You can't go out with that. You're not going to see Lou's face.
That's probably why he's treating these guys as well as he is as well. Yeah.
You guys, you don't say a word about what you've seen, all right?
Yeah.
Man,
so,
I didn't watch the English one, but if he doesn't sound like that, I'm going to be disappointed.
I didn't watch the dub either. I don't think it was available.
There is no English dub. There's like dubs in French and Spanish and other things, but as far as I can see, no English.
Really?
One.
Huh.
You Americans can eat shit. So, the groom at this wedding is the manager of a bar owned by this Godfather Yakuza guy. And he used to be he used to be the boss of the baby's mother. So he is going to call around to see if he can figure out what happened to this woman. Meanwhile, in the middle of this call, the most Godfather of Godfather things happens, and someone tries to assassinate the Godfather.
Let's back up one quick step.
Oh, man,
and...
okay.
No, we do, because isn't that guy the guy who fucked over
scammed
Gene?
It's the bookie.
It's coincidence on top of coincidence. Not only is this guy like, yeah, I recognize that broad from the picture, he's actually has involvement with Gene from Gene's tragic past. Yeah.
Yes, incredible coincidence in this scene. Gene is about to bash this man's head in with a bottle, and all the while this is happening, we see earlier in the scene there's this darker skinned waitstaff, and they pull a gun and shoot up this same bookie.
Well, they're actually shooting the mob boss, but the guy that Gene was about to crack his skull open jumps in the way of the fucking bookie
to save his life after this mob boss had complained about this kid on the drive over.
This kid's a real piece of shit. But like, and also Gin was literally like, I'm gonna kill that motherfucker. And then he fucking jumps in front of the bullets for you.
Yes. Yeah. yes, this person loses their wig, and it turns out that's actually a man, and takes Miyuki and the child, Kyoko, hostage, and takes them to sort of a safe house,
like a super low rent apartment, basically, because Miyuki, even though she's she's living as a homeless person, she's like, oh, this part of the neighborhood looks pretty rough. There's like syringes on the ground and shit.
This assassin is somewhere from South America and speaking Portuguese or something equivalent to it, and it says, I don't know, very nice to meet you. I don't speak over the language.
She's trying English on him, but I recognize every maybe fucking sixth or seventh word. I think it's Spanish he's speaking, but my Spanish is fucking terrible.
The subtitles for this just say speaking Spanish.
I fucking love that. It doesn't even
translate it.
If you don't know fucking Spanish, it's just like, you're in the same position as the other characters. They don't have a fucking clue what this guy's
saying. Exactly, yeah. That was a nice touch.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
But still being, even though I've taken them hostage, I'm smiling and thinking, oh, you got a little baby there. That's very nice. So you're thinking, this fella, even though he shot up mob boss, some kind of turf war going on, he's not all bad. It's okay. He's going to
he took this person and a baby as a hostage, but he's like, I think he's saying stuff like, I'm not going to hurt you. We're just going to get someplace safe to keep our heads down kind of thing. Because he takes her to stay with his wife, who is pregnant, who had his kid, so she can feed both the babies.
Hmm.
Yes, while he lays low. It's like, he's not going to fuck her over. It's like, listen, you got me out of there, so I'm not going to try and kill you or anything.
In what is maybe the coziest scene of this entire movie.
It's actually nice for once.
It's really pleasant. It's really nice. This lady is trying to tell Miyuki all about, her family and her life while she's breastfeeding this child, and they put him to bed, and she's reciprocating, and they're looking through photos, and this is when we find out the backstory about Miyuki stabbing her father for losing Angel, this cat. So it's a nice piece there. Meanwhile, Gin and Hana are trying to find Miyuki and the baby, and I believe at this point Gin basically gives up and splits off from Hana. Whereas Hana, tracks down the cab that took this guy and Miyuki to the safe house, and this is the beginning of our running gag with the cab man. She tracks him down, and Gin is sort of trying to come to terms with himself. He's drunk at this point. I guess I'll go into that really quick. He finds an elderly man on the ground who is also homeless, and helps him back to his home and works with him. It's clear that this man is at death's door and is dying. I just said that. Is at death's door and helps him home and helps him drink. And this man, says, well, I have a secret and I need you to keep this safe and don't show it to anybody. He hands him a bag, which we will find about later. A group of rowdy teens come up and beat them both with pipes, because apparently that's what teens do around New Year.
I think that was a thing that happened at least once, if not several fucking times, where they're like, oh, we're going to clean up the streets. And since the homeless population isn't anything anyone cares about, nothing was done about it. It's fucking horrible.
It comes a lot in anime, especially, but it was of a shocking incident that it needs to be repeated over and over again. And there could be cases like this that we've just never ever heard about either. It must be enough of a phenomenon, or enough notoriety anyway, for it to feature so regularly in stories concerning this.
Well, I mean, the fact that it happened even once is horrific enough.
I was wondering, with a film like this, where the line, where this film would cross the line, where would the step too far be? I thought maybe it would be with Hana, maybe it would be somewhere else. For me, the line too far was when the fucking teenager beat the dead body with a pipe.
That was super nasty.
Broke.
Yeah,
a lot of this movie is heartbreaking, but that hit me in a way that I was not prepared for.
Like that character, the crazy old man, I what I like about him is it's presented as this guy could be like God or something like that, because, you know, he's like, oh, I need one last favor and another drink. And then he thinks he dies and he tries to close his eyes flip back open.
Like, yeah, yeah.
Like, oh, it's a really funny scene, and the guy's really funny. And like it shows the shot of outside of his house and all the pinwheels on his, on his shack stop blowing in the wind, and when we think he's dead, but then he comes back alive and they start blowing again.
It's like, sorry about that, it's just like dying for real now.
There was a moment when he finds him in the street that I thought they were going a different direction with this, and it looked like he was wearing the same clothes as Gein. I thought it was supposed to be like a Ghost of Christmas Future.
This
like
is what you could be. That kind of thing.
Yeah. I thought that too. Yeah. Well,
I think it was suggesting that this guy could be God. This guy could be a reflection of what Gein could be or will be. That kind of thing. Yeah. Mm.
And I think it was totally intentional. I think that's kind of what they were going for.
Yeah.
I feel like it's all. It could be one thing, it could be the other, or it could be all of them wrapped up together. I mean,
and it's nice that they don't really acknowledge it beyond that, because it leaves, you know, some room for interpretation, which is great.
The other thing he could be is Santa, because he does leave him with a very important gift, and he does have the white beard
in a red
bag.
That's
true. Oh my goodness.
Oh no, Santa's dead.
Oh, and those poor teens are not going to get anything for Christmas.
Well, good.
Good.
Speaking of a gift.
I don't know.
I hope they get arrested
teens.
For Christmas.
Yes.
Yes. Speaking of a gift, the teens steal something out of Gein's pocket, which is, if you're familiar with red packets, it's similar to that. Yeah. It's in a white envelope, which is typically, you know, it's given for New Year's as a gift. And we find out that it contains 30,000 yen, which is about $300, which Gein had saved up in order to give to his daughter, who is still alive. Spoiler alert.
What I like about that is we see Gein get the utter shit kicked out of him by these guys, and then they go off because there's some girls they want to fucking chat up. But then when that thing's gone, it cuts away, and when it cuts back to him, he's bloodied and bruised, but he has a fucking fistful of that envelope, and he's just like, you know, he kicked those motherfuckers' ass.
So good. And he's like even more beat up, but it's like you should see the other guy sort of situation.
Yeah, he's the one who fucking walked away with the envelope.
The kids are probably fine. He just got away. But still, to have the gumption to go back for a second round of that takes a lot of guts. And it's seeing.
See, I feel like it would be too cathartic to see him kick those pieces of shit's ass.
Yeah.
It feels good to. It's like, oh, he fucking got the thing he wanted. Yeah. Good. I'm glad.
With some kind of camera justice where, like, they dragged the old man's body out and hit it as well and think, oh, the crew got done because, oh, they dragged him out and they fucking beat him with a pipe and then he died and now you're going to get sent to fun juvenile detention. It's like, oh my gosh, that probably wouldn't fit in the same way with a tone of the film. Villains, every say of the piece, like, they have either a comical or a more sympathetic end, so I would probably kind of be going against the message you're trying to
It also kind of serves as sort of an economical story point where just like the movie knows it needs to move on, so maybe it would be more impactful if we just didn't show that. You know,
the Greek method of showing it, having it happen off screen, which I think is good.
The closest thing it came to like a fight scene was the dude makes a Bruce Lee noise and then fucks up the kick when he was kicking the shit out again. But I mean, like we're not gonna have a fight scene in this thing, guys. We're taking the piss out of movies that do that. Even though the rest of the movie, as they say in the movie, is an action movie.
Yeah,
yes.
They keep comparing Gein to an action hero and the fact that he's not one, and then whether or not he becomes one at the end.
Yeah.
In probably my favorite gag in the entire movie, though, Gein is passed out or like, you know, nearly passed out in an alleyway, and an angel shows up. The person dressed up as an angel shows up and goes, "My magic or an ambulance? Which would you prefer?" And he goes, "An ambulance."
Angel's like, "Motherfucker! How fucking dare you spurn me like this?
Fuck you, buddy."
And we come to find out that this angel is either an employee or a regular at this drag bar.
I think she's an employee,
That Hana and Miyuki, after Hana, you know, re-encounters Miyuki and Kyoko, takes them to this drag bar that she used to work at. Come to find out, I think it's Tower Angels, I think it's called, because it's next to Tokyo Tower. I'm not
Yeah, I think like kind of features around Tokyo Tower, a lot of the scenes do. Like earlier when Gein saw the two buildings, like you could view at the back of the old man's thing. Again, it had what position they were in related to Tokyo Tower. They were trying to find where this picture was taken.
Yeah. And right. Because this, the rest of the city is so sort of stark and grey or covered in snow, and then Tokyo Tower is still so like lit up and red and so kind of brilliant in the night. It's sort of like a big Christmas tree, or possibly like a guiding star if you want to go for the Three Wise Men route. You know?
It is how they navigate around the place. Yeah, that's true.
And at this point, we receive more of Hana's backstory that, you know, she used to have a like a husband or a lover named Ken, and they used to live together, but he passed at some point. And after an incident, she stopped working at Tower Angels as well, and the rest is sort of left up to our imagination. But I think the implication is that she didn't you know, have the courage to face anybody after this string of incidents.
Yeah,
like a lot of the things in this film is like, I have a tragic backstory, but most of the tragic backstory is kind of your own fault.
It's a lot of it is I'm too ashamed or embarrassed to go
too
back.
Too proud to go back.
Exactly.
And yeah, right. It's just like Hannah thought, oh, well, I couldn't come back after making a scene at that. And her drag mother is like, well, so we're taking it back any time, like families, they have like things all the time, but we make up and we get past it because we're family. And
right, and that's that. It what is Christmas if not an excuse to get back together with family and get over things like shame and embarrassment and regret? Right.
Yeah.
Like we have these three homeless people who have made a kind of a family. Because they all lost their family, and none of them have lost their family.
Yeah, it's like you're forming a surrogate family, which by circumstances, wherever they are, you found yourself out, and you kind of form this thing. Like, but the surrogate family, they accept you and love you, or whatever like that. Anyway, but they also remind
everyone in the family has forgiven.
Like they fill that void in your heart, in your soul, and they remind you of what you lost, and what you cherish, and what you can't have a game, but you can have maybe like something, some kind of equivalent or even better to it. But as I said, in this case of these guys, it's just like, maybe I should pick up the phone and get back in touch with my long lost daughter.
All right, gents, we really need to motor through the rest of this plot. So I know there's so much still left to say, but I'm gonna try to do my best.
Sure.
So at this point, they decide to redouble their efforts to find the parents and begin their sort of long journey to this. It's in the background of these photos that they find. It's not Tokyo Tower, but it's this distinctive double tower with a bridge between it. It's not the town hall, because the town hall is at the very beginning.
It's not the Met building.
And they're living. Yeah, they're living near the town hall. So it's sort of implied that it's far away, it's on the outskirts, it's probably out in actually like a neighboring prefecture that's still part of the urban sprawl sort of.
Yeah, it's a view that they don't have where they're living, and it is very distinctive towers, so
so they get out to near where that is, and they come to find out, they stop one night over in an abandoned house, and they come to find out that this is the house in the photograph. And they ask all of the local gossips, all of the local mothers and women around what happened to these people. But doing a little self-investigation in the house, they find the address of an apartment complex. At the same time, you could also find some old newspapers, including one that has a classified that says, "Come home, we found Angel, please call us."
I really like that. That was such a nice, like, it was a hit emotionally, but it was kind of like, oh fuck, man, that's rough.
Yeah, she in one sort of scene by itself, she tries to call and tries to work up the wherewithal, and her father picks up the phone, and she can't bring herself to say anything and just hangs up. It's heartbreaking. All right, let's keep on trucking. So at some point, I can't remember if this is before or after they visit the apartments, Hana falls ill. Oh yeah, no. Okay. While Miyuka's making this call, they're in a convenience store, Gein and Hana, and there's this drunk salaryman that's basically demanding them to leave because they're, you know, he thinks that they're unsightly homeless people, and that the argument is taken outside, and then apropos of nothing, an ambulance comes crashing into the whole of the convenience store.
Like obliterating the entire fucking inside. The guy, the guy who falls out of the ambulance is like, somebody call an ambulance.
It's also very good.
But then Hana like immediately like, looks at the baby Kyoko and says, "Kyoko is the messenger of God,
divine retribution."
Like, just what?
I'd call Hana miracle. Crazy, but in this movie, I'm like, no, she's fucking 100% right. There's something about this fucking kid. It's lucky.
Yes. But at some point in the next part of the proceedings, is it during the chase scene? No, it's before that. No, Hana falls ill, and they have to go to the hospital, and Gein ends up paying the $300 that he had saved up for his daughter for Hana's medical bills. And come to find out, the nurse working there is Kyoko, a different Kyoko, which is Gein's daughter.
Two Kyokos.
I'm seeing double here.
Yes, and that's why he was not a fan of the name originally. Talk about a coincidence. So we come to find out the rest of Gein's backstory is that he was an alcoholic and a gambler and had gambled, owned a bike shop with his wife and had gambled his way into a deep debt and could not face it any longer and basically ghosted his family. But he's eager to sort of meet back up with his family, and his daughter reveals that, you know, we never gave up on you. We never stopped looking for you. And she gives him his phone number, but there are more important things to do. Hana tells off Gein at this point.
I love that because it's like, Gein's a piece of shit, you find out. Then his daughter forgives him, and he's like, oh, could you bring me back into your life, dear daughter? Of course, father. And he's like, no, that guy's a motherfucker. Let me just fucking let me fuck him out of it right now. And it's a pretty hilarious scene. But then later on, she's says, like, it's family. She'll forgive him. I just needed to put it all out there because rather than have it seethe under the surface, it's like, it's better that she knows he's a piece of shit now so she can forgive him fully.
I had to Harry and the Hendersons him, or else we'd never get these two back together.
Yeah, it's great. And then Hana tells a really great story, which I'm not going to get into. Watch the film. It's good. Yes. Sort of like a parable related to the action she just took. And then Hana and Miyuki are walking along a bridge, and they find a woman about to commit suicide. Oh, so they grab her off of the ledge.
I love how kind of subtly that down. Is sort of like set up. Like there was Hana and Miyuki just walking along, kind of chatting about what we're going to do about this baby. We'll do our best to try to find this baby. And we see someone crossing the road on the other side, and then getting up on the railing, and then they walk about, and then this clocks it. Then wait! Don't do that! Don't jump! Just kind of dash out of frame to try and kind of save this person from jumping off.
Yeah,
I think they're literally talking about like people killing themselves or something like that.
Yeah, I think actually they were talking about Miyuki was like, well, if I was going to commit suicide, I'd take my shoes off and then step up on a railing, and somebody out of the person in the background is doing literally that. It's played up a little bit. And
you know, the
again,
holidays
this movie...
is the number one time for suicides in Japan. Don't you know that?
So again, this movie is walking this tightrope between comedy and tragedy, and it's pulling it off really. And hold on, I gotta pull one of my earphones because it's about to die.
It's one of those cases where we have to laugh at these things, and the film kind of has this sort of air of we have to laugh at this, or else we would be crying at it.
Mm.
Yeah. It's laughter because you don't know what to do with it emotionally. And also sometimes it's actually funny. So laughter is the natural progression. It's like, I don't know how to feel about this.
Oh my God. But all then, right. So.
Should I keep going? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. All right. Come to find out that this is the very woman that they're looking for. And Hana proceeds to slap the hell out of her, you know, because she gave up this baby. And they give the baby back to her, and it's a Christmas miracle that they found her. But come to find out that this baby has been reported stolen. Yeah. Now things are
getting
a little
Gein
odd.
How does meet that mother's husband? I've forgotten the specifics of that, because he tracks the guy down into his fucking nasty-ass apartment.
He saw the news report on it anyway.
About
the baby being kidnapped. I think they... I think they got the intel or the address from the gossips in the neighborhood about where he might be, or what was it again? Yeah, they had that.
And yeah, then I think Dean the had the address.
And,
thinks,
oh,
and then
these guys are going to be in here, right? And then he seems opens the door. The door apparently is unlocked, and it's just this awful, decrepit place, packed high with rubbish bags from floor to ceiling. And there's some just dude in there asleep watching TV. And it's like, it's you. You're the guy. You fucking gave up that baby. Von, what are you thinking? You're the fucking father in this. It's supposed to be responsible. And it's like, it's not my baby. Whoa, what? I got to lay out the whole deal for you. Me and my wife are going through some stuff right now. So she took it upon herself to go to the hospital, and she stole that fucking baby, man, because she thinks that having a baby will, like, help us to resolve our difficulties.
Yeah, well, she actually, like, she tried to get pregnant because she thought if she and her husband had a baby together, that would be the thing that would unite them back together. And she had a miscarriage, and in her grief, she stole one of the newborns there because she went, oh, that's totally my baby there. Which is, like, as close to a villain as this movie gets, besides those fucking teenagers, that's really, like, pitiable and just like, oh, you poor woman, like, you know. But obviously, we do need to get that baby off that woman right now.
More importantly, we need an action-packed chase scene involving trucks and bicycles and taxis.
And a certain taxi driver that we've met before to lead the way.
He's just my type.
It's a good thing,
the kind of man.
It's a good thing it happens over several days, because this guy would have had the worst night ever if this all happened in one night.
Yeah.
He's just had a bad week, basically, at this stage.
Yeah. I suppose has a bit of like, oh, the kind of man I love is a sort of guy who, a kind of man in uniform, but not a soldier. Maybe he's got a kind of a buzz cut like one, though. Kind of going through who's got his own job, drives a car, and wouldn't be averse to letting a nice lady like me off with the fare when it doesn't have quite enough for it, right? And then, I don't know, they're just like tight buzz, and it's just as soon as like this chasing is about to begin, we gotta get a taxi, follow that taxi, and it's just this guy pulls up his phone saying, oh no, these guys again. What are the odds?
But, the chase scene ends at the top of this very tall, what I'm assuming is some kind of apartment building, where the mother is once again threatening. You're gonna stop.
I think it's a shopping complex because of the banners out front.
Okay.
It's and it's closed for New Year's. Yeah.
And it's got a wide lobby.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Anyways.
The film ends. The big climactic scene ends at the top of this building. The mother is going to jump off with the baby, and through many, many several minor miracles, they convince her otherwise, and that she should not do that. And I'm not going to go into specifics, because honestly, it's kind of a Christmas miracle the way this happens, and that's perfectly fine. And see, this is the thing: we've gone through the entire plot, and we got right up here to the end, where I'm averse to saying what happens at the end because I just want people to see it.
Yeah.
Just like, I watched the American trailer and it like gives you a hint of what it is. So don't fucking watch that trailer. No. It's a shitty trailer anyway. Just watch it. And the bit with Hannah just being super badass, and then the crazy thing that happens, and then everyone in the, like, in the scene just looking on dumbfounded and going like, the fuck? It was kind of great.
How do they do that?
It's really. Yeah.
It's a lovely ending. Yeah. And then kind of the button on the end of the film is that there's like one last coincidence, which is that who is it? It's Miyuki's father is the police officer who is charged with bringing everyone back together at the end.
Yeah,
finding this baby.
He's charged with finding the baby. So the parents want to go meet the people who found, who got their baby back to them, and make them the godfathers.
Yes.
Or the godparents.
And
it basically just ends on the Miyuki, dad, what record scratch? And the baby just laughs and goes, ha 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 ha. It's all thanks to me. Welcome back together again.
We're treated to one last happy coincidence as well.
Yes.
For those that had been paying attention, in the earlier scene in the hospital waiting room, they announced the winning lottery numbers, and it's remarkable what the winning lottery numbers are. It's all ones, and this is the New Year's lottery. And we are treated with a shot of the bag that the old man had handed Keen, and in it are lottery tickets, and one of those lottery tickets is nothing but ones.
My gosh.
So you never know. Sometimes that might be the best number to pick. You never know.
Like, I like the way that's
statistically.
It's bound to come up sometime,
pretty much. But I like the way, like, the film just cuts at them, the father and daughter, looking at each other, going like, what? And then that's it. Film over. Presume everyone lives happily ever after. Go home now.
They're set now. They won the jackpot. They can just divvy it up between themselves. And Miyuki's probably going to return to real life. Because what I like about the ending as well, it gives Miyuki sort of a good chance to shine and do something sort of heroic and decent and good as well. And
something that will get her, like, in her mind is like, now she has regained her honor by saving a baby, so maybe she can forgive herself.
But I like the detail of they're chasing Sachiko, like, up onto the roof, and Miyuki just says, okay, I can't wait for the lift to go. I use the stairs to get up there, and she's kind of running up these like 50 flights of stairs, and she's absolutely boxed after her. But she's discarding items of clothing as she goes out because she's getting overheated, and she's just kind of taking off all the layers that she's acquired from being even on the streets, the big coat, the big hat, all that stuff, and she's just down to like her jumper and her skirt and her boots, like this, just down to that. She's down to sort of what she ran away in, essentially. And
She's pulled away her layers of that she's built up as homelessness, as her defense and everything like that. And then she has to talk down this mother whose kid had died in childbirth and now wants to kill herself with someone else's kid. And she has to talk about being a good parent and love and that kind of shit, which is something that she lost. And the fact that she had to strip away those layers just before that in order to be able to talk this person down from that ledge, using the thing that she ran away from home, or the opposite of the thing she ran away. It's fucking
she
wonderful.
Understands now. She understands. But it's also
the thing that she kind of gained over the course of the film, having to care for this baby over the last
3-4
days. So she's kind of gained that sort of self-confidence and that sort of sense of responsibility where she doesn't have to run away and hide from her parents anymore. She can just be her own person, and that she kind of self-actualizes there at the very end. It's very well done. It's very touching. Hmm. That's Tokyo Godfathers. It's a great film. Mm. I really can't nitpick it too hard because why would you? Mm. It's a film about coincidences and miracles and de facto families, and you know, I don't know. This is one of the more Christmassy, like genuine Christmassy things we've watched in a long time.
Yeah.
That's kind of ironic.
Isn't it though?
I think it's like for all of, I think based on not listening to some things you've gone about before, it often swings too much one way. With like it's all going to be like ultra tragedy or ultra farce. And this has some like super real moments in it that really cut you to the core. But in amongst all that, it's quite a funny film. And it as well, it embraces the medium that it's in. It's very cartoony. A lot of these characters are larger than life. They're absolute, like, I wouldn't say caricatures, but they are, like, doing actually kind of ridiculous things that you would only kind of do in a cartoon and kind of really kind of selling and really embracing what it's done. Because I think the Oscars leveled at Satoshi Kon, one of his films, like, well, these are all set in, like, real-world locations, are often about, average, like, people. No, there's no, like, crazy robots or spaceships or anything like that. Why would you do that? But Satoshi Kon, he was, like, an animator and a manga artist, you know, way back when, long before he became, like, this revered director. And so you don't ever quite lose that. He wants to, like promote all that and keep all that up on the screen. But as well as a kind of a practical aspect, because you would have a very hard time trying to get permits from like the Tokyo City Council to allow you to film a feature about homeless people sitting up and like sets and things with like shanty towns and that kind of stuff. Which is a problem they're trying to keep under wraps, and to have it like out there right there in the street for anybody to see is not something they would probably approve of.
Like a decent enough budget is especially for the action scenes and everything. You could easily have filmed this, but Satoshi Kon was like, I'm an animator and I'm a cartoonist, that kind of way first and foremost. And the thing about doing cartoons is a director directs actors, but an animator or a cartoonist, they act with their drawings. So they're involved in that process of it. And if you got someone else to do that, if you directed someone else to do the acting for you, it wouldn't have the same voice. And that's very important to this.
Yeah. Also, as well, again, the snow. It would be, again, pretty hard to just, like, you know, bring up, like bag upon bag of fake snow and troll on everywhere in the set. And I had to clean all that up for at the end of the film. Yeah. Whereas in an animated film, well, if you want snow, you got it. As long as you're able to convey it convincingly, then it's there. Anything you kind of need.
Absolutely, yeah. So I think now is the time in the show where we take a stroll over to the Crankometer, which is our patented scale for how to rate these Christmas films on an X and Y axis, because we are a bunch of mad scientists here at Christmas Creeps. This is the thing we've concocted for ourselves. The X axis is how Christmassy a film is, and the Y axis is how good a film is, sort of the quality axis. So gentlemen, Tokyo Godfathers, X axis, how Christmassy is Tokyo Godfathers?
Man, it is pretty festive. Trying to get a baby home to his parents for Christmas. That's what all the classics are made about, man. That kind of maybe not that kind of, but that kind of feeling, that kind of sympathy, that sort of emotion. So, you know, the temptation is here is just like crank it up to 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. But
what's the high end of it?
The high end is 5. We very rarely have broken it off and gone to 6, but the top of the scale is 5. So, for my part, every time "Ode to Joy" came up on the soundtrack, that song is just like catnip for me, basically. Like, once that song plays, I think in my head, this is definitely Christmas right here. Like, it works in this, it works in Die Hard. It's just.
Perfect. Yeah, that came on, I think, in the hospital waiting room. I like to think that in the waiting room, that they had Die Hard on the telly and just happened to be at that scene in the film when they played up.
Right, like the moment that Gein meets his daughter again for the first time and that song kicks in, you're like, oh, this is like the perfect moment right here. Hmm. It's beautiful. And then
it's
over the
Christmassy
credits,
as hell.
And then over the credits, they play this strange sort of calypso-tinged version of it. I don't know what the lyrics are because the movie didn't translate them for me, but I don't know. That's the thing that got me over the Christmas mark was like, "Ode to Joy" all around. Love it.
Let's say you took this movie, right, and you rewrote it considerably. Yes. So it's still about homeless people. Instead of it being like an unforeseen snowstorm in winter, it's heavy rainfall in autumn or something like that. You set it at a different part of the year. It's not the same movie. Even if you change everything to make sense to that time of year, it doesn't work as well. It needs the magical Christmas element, even amongst all the shittiness of this fucking awful world that they present.
It
needs that Christmasness to make you go like, yeah, that seems legit.
I place in the context of the holiday. Like, Japan isn't as big. Christmas isn't big a holiday in Japan. No, it's not like you don't have a day off for it. But it is still acknowledged as a time for like miracles and great deeds to occur, and the coincidences that are kind of miracles, but the more they're sort of reinforced, the ties where the both seen and unseen that we have with people we meet in our lives, you keep running into the same people like every day. Could be like, you know, just the same person serves you at a supermarket like every week when you go there for groceries, you know, and when you realize it or not, you've seen this person every week, although you may not realize it. And so I mean, you kind of like acknowledge that it happens. It's kind of it's apparent to you, and as well, like besides the miracles, there's just like coincidence happening where they are in the right place at the right time. Some of them are just achieved through like great devotion and effort too. I got that kind of that thing running through the film with Gein saying, "Oh, I couldn't be an extra like that," but then at the end of the film, he's hanging out the side of a speeding truck. He's a fucking action star. Yeah, he makes good on his lie as well, because Shane was a big bike racer. He hops on the bike, like, without having to ask or reason. And he's like, in pursuit of that truck on bicycle, on a bicycle. Like, you know, he's making good on his effort. And a miracle happens. He makes his own
a
luck.
Police bicycle.
He stole a police bicycle, but he's making good. He's making it happen. He's, like, really living up to the lie that he's built up for himself. It's great. So yeah, we just got to land on a number here. I would say at least a 4, Brad. What do you think?
I was thinking a 4. I could be pushed to a 5, but the 5 is this ephemeral. I can't put my finger on it. You already mentioned my litmus test of could this be rewritten, could this be rewritten in a different season and still retain the exact same sort of thing? And I would argue that no, that is not the case. If only because the fact that this is set at Christmas allows us to sort of suspend our disbelief on these coincidences happening, because it's Christmas. Miracles happen at Christmas. Forgiveness happens at Christmas. I think, like you said, this film has more, it's not necessarily about Christmas, but it has more of that Christmas feeling than a lot of films we watch all about Christmas. Mm. It captures the feeling and the essence of Christmas so much better than a lot of what we
it's
watch.
It's the empathy, really. Again, what Tosha was trying to get across is that these people, these homeless people in the street, they aren't degenerates. They aren't like, they wouldn't choose to swim suits if they wanted to. And they are capable of good deeds. They're capable of incredible great deeds as well. And maybe it takes Christmas to make them do that, but no, it was still in them all the time to do it. And it took something like this to come into their lives to try and bring it out of them.
Like, right. It's tough Christmas because it's kind of like one of my favorite Christmas stories, A Christmas Carol. It's like A Wonderful Life. It shows you humanity at its lowest, and that allows you to see the miracle of family and caring about each other and empathizing with each other and trying to do the fucking impossible and change your ways and that kind of thing. And that's super fucking Christmassy.
Absolutely, it is, and also for me, what I'm thinking of right now is like the way this film just humanizes people that most films don't typically humanize, like we touched on before. Another film that I'm going to bring up real quick, Home Alone 2, where Kevin goes through Central Park in the middle of the night and he sees homeless people and they're just portrayed as literal monsters. It's horrible the way that film treats homeless people. But then here, I mean, the pigeon lady would probably fit in right at home in Tokyo Godfathers, but she's really the only one, like, because the film actually takes the time to humanize her and get to know her. But then all these other sort of caricatures we see are there. It's just a horror show. And this film puts you right in the middle of it right away. So you don't really have time to look at these homeless people and say, who are these people? Why are we following them? Like, this is it. This is it for us.
Yeah, in Home Alone 2, it never takes the time for the pigeon lady to be, like, talked to as, like, hey, Frank, how's the wife? And that kind of shit. You know, it's like, they never, she doesn't have interactions with the other ones. And so you kind of get to humanize them. But in Tokyo Godfathers, Miyuki, like, bumps into two homeless guys. And they're like, wait, is that Jin's kid? It's like, oh, we're not going to touch you. And he's like, what? It's like, Jin fucking adores you. He's fucking, he'll do anything for you. We're not going to mess with you, kind of thing. So even those other homeless guys are just like, yeah, we're cool, you know. And they're just random one-scene fucking characters. But it takes the time to humanize them and show that they know and that there's a fucking community and they understand other people's inner lives. It goes the full gamut to try and make them fully developed characters.
Yeah, for Hannah as well, who's doubly ostracized by both being a trans woman and also being homeless, it's like you've like twice as much on your plate to try and I contend with. And again, inspiring it at empathy and sympathy and showing that this person is like a human being with emotions and feelings and a wonderful, brilliant, charitable, great heart. And it's kind of challenging you as well. Especially when you see the reactions of people would say, like, in the convenience store or on the train, they're just going, ooh, no, homeless people. Could you, a proper person in polite society, would you have it in yourself to take it at the task of trying to find this baby's parents, trekking high and low across this giant city to try and find it? Could you do that? No, it takes a certain person. It doesn't matter whether they're homeless or otherwise to do that. And this is someone that is, like, they're a saint. They're inherently good. They've made some mistakes in the past, but that's not something you can kind of pity them for forever and ever, you know?
A comeuppance I really liked in the film was to do with Hannah, but it wasn't. It was to do with a character interacting with her, where they were going to like the soup kitchen and getting some stuff, and they were she was talking about how it's like, oh, I'd love to have kids, but you know, I can't. Obviously, not got the right junk for it, and that kind of thing. And she, when she goes up to the person putting out the soup, is like, oh, can I get a double serving? I'm eating for two, kind of thing. And your one kind of serving goes like, all right, whatever. But then she sees her later on with the baby, and she's like, it's a miracle.
Yeah, she was
eating for two.
I think the actual literal translation of what that lady says is, it's a miracle. But they translate it as, she was eating for two.
Okay.
I think you just get points for that, just for... Like, being able to kind of take jabs at this
perception
at this community and at this community of people, but it's ultimately not too derogative of them, which is something I'm all too used to encountering in anime as well. It's just like, oh, I'm waiting for it now. It's going to be, oh my god, a man in a dress. That's hilarious. I mean, it's only been like, there's been encouraging trends in the last couple of years from. Couple of things we've been watching actually regularly for our other podcast where people who either are maybe just they're just like cross-dress or it could be fully transgender. There is actually something that came up there where this issue, this sort of content, found its way to the UK Parliament I think days ago, a week ago, recording.
That was fucking class. Yeah, yeah.
There was a...
You're holding a picture up of... what's the character's name?
It's Lily from an anime called Zombieland Saga, which is basically a mad scientist resurrects various pop idols from various eras and one average schoolgirl to try and form an idol group to try and revitalize interest in this particular area of Japan and also keep on the rest of that zombies. But one of them is Hoshino Lily, who was a child star. She was so wonderful and great on telly and sings so well. But it was revealed at a point that when she was alive, she was born a boy. But she was raised as a girl and unfortunately passed away as a young child. But she's reborn as a zombie and saying, well, yeah, I'm a zombie now and I'm a girl. I always felt I was a girl and I have a new existence. I've literally been reborn and I'm going to be a girl.
She's super happy to be a girl zombie because that means that she won't grow old into a guy, that kind of way. Her voice won't deepen and that kind of thing. So it's like, oh, this fucking works out for me. And everyone just treats her like a girl. It doesn't change it. They're like, oh, you're born a boy. Huh.
Yeah.
Well, still a girl. Not doesn't make a difference. You're still in the girl band. I don't see how that changes anything.
Yeah. It was.
There's a lot of things like that that are like you said, they're showing a lot of people are talking about the shit that you're not supposed to talk about in a positive way.
Yeah. It was a really great moment of acceptance, which of course the people on the internet, curmudgeons, didn't like. but it came up anyway as a result of what was it in the UK Parliament discussing Twitter and on social media there was this cesspool of like abuse and derogatory language, and this I think she was a Scottish MP brandishing this like Photoshop or fan art picture of Lily Hoshino with a caption reading basically something to the effect of "fuck off turfs." And it's just, MP saying, "Down with this sort of thing." As you can see,
I think it was like her, like doing the thing where she holds a finger out with her tongue out, like kind of a cheeky wink, and like someone had photoshopped in her holding a gun, pointing at the viewer, and like "turfs can die." I've forgotten the specific caption, and I'm just like, that's fucking brilliant that's happened in reality. It's been pulled out of fucking fiction into reality. It's beautiful. Amazing.
Yeah.
What's up, Super World?
Well, okay, so. Here's what we're gonna do. Let's just go ahead and call a spade and say, Christmassy, this is a nat 5.
It's at least a 5, if not more. I would say.
I don't think it gets better than this. To be perfectly honest, this is the film that I think future holiday films are going to have to live up to, which is a tall order, I realize. So on the y-axis, then, how good is this film, gentlemen? We need to wrap it up here. But I think the long and short of it is this is as solid and as well crafted a film as we've ever discussed on this show.
I'm getting 5. I'm just gonna say 5.
I would say I give it a 4. Obviously, room for improvement. 4.5. I don't know.
Fuck off. It's a 5.
Okay.
If you've watched half of the Drek that we have watched for this podcast, you would give this a 5 as well.
Yeah, honestly, the only other like 5 fives we've watched in this show were Die Hard, Christmas Fair. Vacation, I believe, mm-hmm. and also Christmas at Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Okay. Oh, so, yeah.
This
yeah.
is water to somebody dying in the desert.
Absolutely it is. Hmm. And a great way to round out our month-long feature of anime holiday specials and films. So Tokyo Godfathers is a 5.5 on your crankometer scale. So go ahead and plot that out, and we will move on to our next feature film, to be determined at a later date, because we don't do that kind of thing on this show. We have no sense of planning or of any kind of scheme going up. We're just following what's available and what we think might be fun. But that's what we do here. So that's been Christmas Creeps. Dwayne and Niall, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having us
today.
Thank
you.
Where can our listeners find you guys if they want to come and listen to your podcast?
All right. You can find our regular podcast about animation of all kinds at secretofthesailormadness.com. That's on iTunes, Stitcher, Pod Directory, and probably a few other podcast hosting things that may have ensnared us in the last while I'm not aware of, but those are the main ones. But basically, just go to the website there, and you can find latest things and also all the older things. You can also, again, our little side gig, as you mentioned before, with another podcast which is anime exclusive called Dynamite in the Brain. We collaborate with them week to week on a thing called Let's Go, which is basically a rundown of weekly streaming anime. So things we're kind of watching on the regular week to week, and we just kind of meet up and talk about it. It's currently in its special incarnation called Let's Go JoJo, which is what I started out as, which is a weekly rundown of the happenings in the latest series of the anime edition of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, but also anything else you watched that week. And that can be found over on dynamiteinthebrain.com, but also be posted at secretofthesailormadness.com. Besides that, social media handles, I'm on Twitter at Nicholas Cage, that is NILLCOLAS_Cage.
I am also on Twitter for my sins at I_M_D.
Bradford, what about you?
You're welcome for this good movie. I'm on Twitter at Fragrant Hills. I'm on a podcast called Christmas Creeps that you're listening to right now.
Wow!
Oh my god, really? Tell me more.
If you want to subscribe to us, we are available on wherever you download this podcast. In addition, we are on iTunes and Stitcher and Google Play Store. And if you could be so kind as to leave us a review or a comment, we would really appreciate it. Even if it's not the most glowing, we're always listening to feedback and we'd love to hear from you. If you want to get in touch with us, you can always email us at christmascreeps@gmail.com.
I'm going to have to stop you right there. It's at xmascreeps@gmail.com.
Do I always... I get it wrong every single time.
Without fail, but that's what I'm here for.
Okay, and we're also on Twitter, and you can just Google us. We're probably somewhere.
We're at Christmas Creeps on Twitter. You can follow us on the social medias, all of those things. Or go to christmascreeps.com, which is your one-stop shop for holiday madness all year round. So, for Christmas Creeps, I have been Joseph Wade.
I'm Bradford.
Oh, I'm Dwayne Maloney.
and I'm Niall Flanagan.
Wishing everybody a happy Mother's Day. Hey, guess what, guys? We forgot to talk about Mother's Day on this show.
Hey, we talk about Hannah all the time. There's plenty of mother kind of going on there.
That's true. we are recording this on Mother's Day. This won't come out for a couple of weeks until then. But so I should have reversed and gone back and talked about that a little bit. Oh, whatever. We're forestalling the inevitable. Here's the end of the show, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
Bye. Feliz Navidad.
Happy Christmas. Happy Christmas.